I'm Christopher Lydon with the Nobel Prize novelist V.S. Naipaul, the world traveler, now 78, still with the inquisitorial eye and merciless pen that record people and patterns with, as he says, a gloomy clarity, which is his signature by now. We're talking about that calm, intrusive Naipaul gaze on Africa in particular, over 40-plus years, most famously perhaps in his masterpiece, A Bend in the River. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude. V.S. Naipaul's new book is called The Mask of Africa. It's an inquiry not into politics or progress, but into religion broadly, the magical systems of belief in old Africa under the modern layers of Christianity and Islam. At the Brattle Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the night before our conversation, Mr. Naipaul distilled his project.
I had expected that over the great size of Africa, the practices of magic would significantly vary, but they didn't. The diviners everywhere wanted to throw the bones to read the future, and the idea of energy remained a constant, to be tapped into by the ritual sacrifice of body parts. In South Africa, body parts, mainly of animals, but also of men and women, made a mixture of what is known as battle medicine. To witness this, to be given some idea of its power, was to be taken far back to the beginning of things. To reach that beginning was the purpose of my book.
We met the next day in his hotel room.
Saridia, may I say, it's a joy to meet you again. After the reading last night, the first person that caught my eye in the square was a man doing magic tricks with cards. And I watched him for half an hour and I said, that's V.S. Naipaul in another suit. It's the magic. It's about the magic. I want you to share the magic.
Well, the magic is in the writing. And it's up to you to detect it, to disentangle things and see what I do. It's not a secret. It's just there. It's laid out on the page.
I asked the magician to do one of the tricks over. He said no magician will do a trick a second time. Could I read you just one passage of magic for me?
Okay.
In Uganda, you write, "To live in a world ruled by witchcraft, a world liable to irrational dissolution in its details, is to be on edge, to be on a constant lookout. Add to this the eternal anxiety about politics, the fear of land being lost. Add the great population of Uganda, the constant feeling of a crowd too great for the land available, the roads, the jobs available." You quote a woman, an educated woman, not poor, overtly Christian, but with a love of her own roots. She said, "Modernity wants us to sweep our culture away, and that will manifest itself in a political upheaval, a conflict between Christianity and traditional religion. In the Lango tradition," she said, "when there was a drought or it was prolonged, all the elders got together and made sacrifices, and it would rain while they were there at it. My grandmother told me this, but the missionaries called it devil worship. Culture does not die," she said. "Today it is called witchcraft." About her own religion, she said, "I talk to myself so as not to get confused. To me, it's all about belief and what treats you well. In traditional religion, it was not about money. It was a communal spirit, and people came together for a common cause like the drought." And then you write, and this to me was magic, "And gradually from the tragedies the newspapers report and from conversations with good people, the visitor arrives at the unsettling idea of a poor country still vulnerable in its people, living on their nerves, and even in its landscape, which might be despoiled after 40 years of civil conflict, still waiting for an upheaval which may solve nothing."
I think what the lady said is very good, very impressive. She's talking about... She's analyzing the situation in Uganda very, very clearly. And the writer, the visitor, was coming in, having very little to add to what she was saying.
Did you tape her, or do you reconstruct those?
I reconstructed it. I did it by hand. I do it always by hand. Hmm.
You trust your memory, so some of her eloquence may be yours.
No, that's hers. I remember the lady.
One little further passage of magic from the same chapter in Uganda. You write all the way back to Kampala, along the curving roads of Toro and the straight roads of Buganda. There were school children in uniform coming out at the end of a school day, walking home to simple dwellings in the fierce sun. It was just after 3, the deadest time of the tropical day, the heat at its worst in all the green, the freshness of the morning long burnt away, together with whatever optimism the new day might have brought. The light and the heat cast a gloomy clarity on what we were driving through. Small houses, small fields, small people. And it seemed that nothing more uplifting was being offered to the children we could see on the road. Uganda was Uganda. Education and school uniforms, giving an illusion of possibility, was easy. Much harder was the creation of a proper economy. There would be no jobs for most of the children we could see, some dawdling on the way home now, killing time in spite of the heat. The latest employment news presented in the newspapers as good news was that, even with all the suicide bombers and mayhem, there were 6,000 Ugandans working as security guards in Iraq. There was also a report of a call for Ugandan English teachers from North Korea.
I wrote that very carefully. I remember it very well. And the thing that called up the greater care, you might have missed it, was a description of the gloomy clarity of the houses and the yards, the gloomy clarity.
Gloomy clarity, that's Naipaul in a phrase.
Yes,
the in gloomy two words.
Clarity, yes. Yeah. Yes. I wrote that, yes. Very carefully.
May I say, I have been to Ghana this year and to India, places you write about, and I think, oh, for some of that magic.
I'm sure you have enough for your own needs.
Well, no, I don't. I'd love to go to school with you. Can you teach it?
No. I can't teach what I do. It's on the page. You see what's to be done. And you do it, if you want to do it like that. But you may want to do it in your own way.
So many things I want to ask you. Should we be surprised that you went back to Africa? I mean, one would have thought that you had made up your mind about that part of the world.
Yes, but you see, I was writing about something very specific. Mm-hmm. I was writing about belief. And even that bit you mentioned from the lady, there's ideas coming through. You see, the book is not a political book.
Yes.
It's not an economic book. It's not a travel book. It's about belief and what is driving people in a profound way.
Well, I think that is part of your magic and part of your instruction, really, that unlike most journalists, you're not following development or trying to figure out an Asian century or something like that. You're not talking even about pop culture?
No.
You have a theme.
Yes.
To me, that's very instructive.
You have to do it in your own way.
Just recall your history with Africa. It's getting on for 50 years that you've gone to Africa for a reason. What were you looking for that you hadn't considered in A Bend in the River or in A Free State?
Well, you see, they're more expatriate books, aren't they? They consider Africans from a distance. And in this book, I wanted to get closer to Africans. In A Free State, the people who are more important are the travelers in Africa, the visitors, the expatriates. The Africans are people in the background. Important, but not people in their own right, as it were.
You also write that to witness the mixtures of battle medicine and body parts and magic, to be given some idea of its power was to be taken far back to the beginning of things. To reach that beginning was the purpose of my book.
Yeah.
In what sense do you regard Africa as the beginning of things?
Well, no, I don't. I was just doing this there, especially to find out about the beginning of religion or religious practices, very mysterious things. How do they start? How do the ideas of reverence, how do they begin? Who gives them? Mm. You know, these are things that have to be noted.
There was the former dean of a university in Gabon who said to you, "Inside us is the forest."
Yes. Yeah.
Almost a thematic line about the whole book.
Yes, yes, yes. What he meant was the forest is so overwhelming that unless you understand what it means to live in the forest, you can't begin to understand belief, African belief, and magic and things like that. It was a very, very moving passage. It's so dark at 7 in the evening. You look at the forest, and at 50 yards, it's a wall,
yes,
a solid wall. We don't live in that kind of world. We don't know it. And Professor Rosatanga was inviting us to contemplate that wall.
You were also learning that the Chinese have designs to take at least 30% of that eternal forest down.
Yes, 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 yes. And they probably will take it down. It's very melancholy, because I think that the local people would like the money, but the local people also have a great regard for the forest. They have a great regard for the trees. They'll tell you that they don't like what's happening. They want the money. The money is good, but they can't bear the idea of these souls, as they call them, being carted away like that. A very spiritual, very poetic way of looking at the forest.
Is it your belief that Africa would be better off if forest religion, forest belief, forest mystery were still, in a sense, the faith of the continent, as opposed to the imported religions, Christianity and Islam?
Well, what I feel is that, and this is only my feeling, and you know, it's very modest, that if people are left to themselves, they probably work out their own way of dealing with things, dealing with the modern world, dealing with what befalls them. That if they have religions, imported religions, that appear to give a structure to everything, they don't develop as they should. That's my feeling.
Servidio, would you call Africa a wounded civilization, as you once called India?
I called India a wounded civilization because I was thinking of the invasions, which really wounded India very badly.
Including the Mughal invasions of...
Yes, yes, yes. All that's part of it.
And then the Brits.
Yes, yes, yes. I suppose Africa is a wounded civilization, too. I suppose so. It's a good way of thinking about it.
Wounded by...
By its own powerlessness.
A fundamental loss of sovereignty.
Yes, yes.
Human sovereignty.
Yes, yes. Yes.
In India this past summer, I must say, I wondered if India's wounds weren't healing.
I haven't been to India for some little time, a few years. I don't know. I don't know.
Odd enough, when I was there, David Cameron, the new British Prime Minister, was there, hat in hand, looking for deals with an economy much bigger, much faster growth than his. India owns British Steel, owns Jaguar cars, owns so much. And I thought, well, India's got something back. And your friend and mine, Tarun Tejpal, said to me, well, yeah, maybe we should occupy them for 400 years or so and rewrite their history and give them a different language and whatnot. But they said maybe it's not worth it. But one has a sense in India, not that the prosperity is general, much less universal, but that India's, as they would say, got its groove back.
I don't think it's as easy as that. It looks very easy. No. India has to develop its own mind. It has to develop its own ideas. It's very much living at the moment on other people's ideas. Even the cinema, which they talk so much about.
Bollywood, yeah.
Yes, a lot of those films are just remakes of Western pictures, you know. They shamelessly pillage other people's ideas and stories. So although it looks to be original and kind of folk art, there is something false about it. And I don't think with Indian writing there is yet something that is seeking to understand the world properly. Well, how can they? The cinema is a copy of the outside cinema.
The music? The poetry?
The music might be. The music might be. The poetry I don't know about.
The fiction? There's a lot of it now. Even in Pakistan is in on the act too.
Yes. I think it's a controversial thing to say, but I think that the fiction is so far a lot of mimicry. As we often say when we are talking about the forms, it isn't just a matter of changing the content of a form that you arrive at a new form. You can't just say, we are not doing English people or American people, we are doing Indian people in these settings and with these stories. And the stories themselves are rather ancient stories now. But I don't want to get too much into this.
Let me just say, I think there's great excitement in this country about your new book on Africa, as there was about your Nobel. I wonder, is it the same way in England?
No.
What's the difference?
They're not too interested in me and my work.
Really, that's hard to believe. You brought them a Nobel when they needed it.
They don't think like that.
Really?
A government officer said when I got the Nobel in 2001, it isn't as though it's the Booker Prize. Explaining why nothing had to be done or no acknowledgement made of it.
Speaking of England, you called Tony Blair a pirate and maybe an idiot too. What was that all about?
I didn't say he was an idiot. I said he was a pirate. A journalist came to see me, a man I like very much, editor of the Tatler, and he raised the subject. And this was quite early on in Mr. Blair's prime ministership. And I said I thought he was a pirate. And lo and behold, it was more right than I knew.
Mm. You said it long before the war in Iraq.
Long before, yes.
And what did you say about the war in Iraq?
Calamity.
Explain.
Well, look what it's done. It's destabilized the whole area, which was quite stable before. You know, Saddam Hussein, he was a tyrant, but he was keeping it all in order. And now there's nothing to keep it in order. But I'm not a political commentator, as you know.
Yeah. Tony Blair is a strange case. He still has a following in this country. People are reading his autobiography. And yet he's the one man in the world, I think, who might have stopped that war.
Yes. I don't know about this. I haven't gone into that.
Yeah. Back to India for one sec. India and its wounds, but Africa and its wounds. I wonder, do you believe these wounds ever heal? And I'm also wondering, is India perhaps a model for the post-imperial world of a very significant kind of recovery?
India's a very big country. Now, if you're very big and you like India, you have a capacity for economic revival. Because if you make a box of matches, your potential market is 1 billion people. Mm. In a way, somehow, it's very hard to go wrong if you have that kind of market. And that can generate an awful lot.
But even in terms of its morale, its culture, its personal life, its mind life, India seems to have reached back to something old and confident and absolutely unique in the world.
No, that's not true.
Not so?
That's a fantasy. That's a fantasy. India reaches back only to the conquest by the Mughals.
Amartya Sen would say it reaches back to Sanskrit India, to Ashoka and the real old-timers. You don't buy that?
Well, I don't, but I don't want to have an argument with such a grand man.
But you don't quite agree.
I don't agree. Yeah. I don't agree.
One of the most interesting people I met in India was a young man who was leaving Bangalore and going back to his own village in Tamil Nadu. He felt, Indians don't know how to do cities. I'd rather be a Hindu in a Hindu community and let my parents finally arrange my marriage and back to the good old ways. And I thought, that's not exactly the trend in the world, but it has a certain plausibility, both in India and I think in Africa too. Do you have any hope for the village?
Not really. Not really. Village is awful. It's an awful place. And I think what you said at the beginning about the development of cities remains true, you know. And there's no way of going around that.
But even in Wiltshire, I sense you have something of the village life.
Not really. Not really. Not really.
I dream of going back to Africa, staying for a while, and imagining a book called Things Come Together. Another fantasy, perhaps.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, you should do it. You should do it. See how it works out.
I'm going to study up on Naipaul more and more and maybe give it a shot. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you for this conversation.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I hope I haven't said anything to offend people.
I wish you would.
No, I don't want to. And if I have offended anyone, they must forgive me.
That's part of your job, is to...
No. No, it's not part of my job.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Vidya.
Thank you.
Naipaul.
Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.